and our main speaker tonight is Pete.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Pete, and I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here tonight at the Atlantic Group. Very excited to be speaking tonight. Very grateful for the opportunity to do some service. I'm very, very happy to be sober. Very grateful to be sober today. I have a little more than 15 years, one day at a time. And my fondest hope, really, and where a lot of my effort goes today, is to try to keep that going one more day. Thanks a lot, Heidi. Thanks, Atlantic Group. And thanks to all of my homies from PAX for coming up to support. Much love. Yeah, I did that. It's going to be like that. There's a certain aspect of performance to everything I do. I admit that freely. I don't mean to offend anyone. What I'm really trying to do is be the most authentic self that I can be for the next... What do I got, Luke, like 29 and a half minutes? the most authentic self that I can be for the next half hour. And really, you know, my job is to just share my experience, strength, and hope, tell a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And you know, that's my intention. You guys ever listen to the to those speakers on MP3? I know that they also have them on discs. There's like guys from California that speak at these big meetings out there. By the way, congratulations on the new job. That's awesome. And the guy always talks about, like, he tells an amusing anecdote on his way to the meeting. Yeah, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to start with, I grew up in Rochester, New York. I was born in 1959. I'll be 50 years old this year. Fact that is not lost on me. More on that later. I started drinking when I was about 14 or 15. And I had like a regular crew of guys that, you know, that we drank with. And I've told this story before. Yeah, I'm going to tell a couple of stories that I always tell. Actually, I almost forgot this. Before I really get rolling, I do want to say that I'm not up here thumping the tub for any brand, any particular brand of sobriety. You know, I'm going to talk about what happened to me and what I did. But if you're looking for somebody to stand over you and hit you over the head with the big book, I'm not that guy. And also, I just want you all to know that as it was given to me, you are all free, as I was free, to have my own experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not my sponsor's experience, you know, not the experience of my friends. Not the experience of all the girls that I had crushes on, and not the experience of the guys that I sponsored, but my own experience. I was free and left alone, mostly, to have my own experience here. So I started drinking when I was about 15 years old, 14, 15. And I said I grew up in Rochester. Did I say that? Say I'm going to be 50? Yeah, I know. I knew that. And it was a freezing cold January evening. And it was my friend Zenon Pavlovich. His parents were immigrants from Ukraine. Anybody named Zenon is Ukrainian, just so you know if you ever meet a Zenon. They might have like a Saint Zenon or something, I don't know. It might have been his 16th birthday. There were five or six of us at this little birthday party, which was us getting, I don't know, three or four fifths, maybe they were quarts, of Tanqueray gin and tonic. His birthday was on January 10th. It's Rochester, okay? Feet of snow. We're outside in a garage drinking Tanqueray and tonic. I have to tell you that little 16-year-old Peter Pavia got annihilated that night along with everyone else. And for whatever reason, we were going somewhere from where we were, but in order to get there, we had to cross this massive expanse of an athletic field. The snow was probably, not an exaggeration now, waist high. Each of us would take two or three steps and collapse into the snow. Get up, take a few more steps, collapse into the snow until we arrived at our destination. I have to tell you that it was never any more fun than it was that night. I was having a blast. Now, there's a little coda to that. 40% of those boys who were 16 years old are dead. If there were six of us there, and I'm not sure that there was a sixth guy, he's dead too. So that makes 50%. Three are still alive. Those are the guys that I drank with. And the reason that I drank with them is because they drank the way I did. And they like to do the things that I like to do. And, you know, we talk about judging people. Trust me, there were no judgments in this group, you know. We were all doing, you know, pretty much exactly what we wanted to do. And, you know, I'm sorry for my absent friends, and I'm really glad I'm here. So it goes on like that, you know, the usual stuff. I went to school. I learned how to drive a car. I never got a DWI. I learned how to drive a car. Back then, the police used to just tell you to go home. So you know that I'm from a different era, right? What did I do? I went to college. I lived in Paris for a little while when I was in school. That was tremendous. I'm so glad I did that. I've done a lot of really stupid things. That was one of the smart things that I did. And I moved to New York in 1984. So I've been here for about 25 years. I immediately found my peers. And when I say my peers, they were the guys that drank the way that I did. Now, I didn't know this at the time, but my life had pretty much become about drinking. Pretty much. Like, when I say I'm an alcoholic, it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, not so much in AA. I think that we have a really good definition of it here. You might want to take a look at the doctor's opinion. I heard about 50 people counting days. You may be unfamiliar with the material. That's fine. Pretty solid description of alcoholism in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I say I'm an alcoholic, what that means to me is when I'm drinking, I am not doing anything else. Number one. Number two, I can be stopped. I have been stopped in the past. Unconsciousness, lack of funds, law enforcement official. I will not stop on my own. I have no desire to stop on my own. And I think as both of our speakers, who were terrific, Travis and Faye, great speakers, did a terrific job, talked about how once I start drinking, I cannot stop. I have no desire to stop. There is no reason to stop. I will wait until I am stopped by some sort of outside force. That's my story, really. So I'm in New York. I find my peers, you know, my peer group. And you know, I'm drinking a lot, like all the time. Morning drinking, I don't know if I was doing so much of that then. That comes later in the story for me. But I will tell you that once you've had that morning drink and you've crossed that line, not such a big deal anymore, you know? It's really not. Yeah, I'm having a drink. So what? I know what time it is. I'm a grown man. So I'm hanging out with this crowd, and let's see. This is the story that I haven't, I don't think, ever told in AA because it's so embarrassing that I blotted it out of my consciousness over the course of the last 15 years. And it's not gross or anything. And, you know, it's not violent, really. No, not really. Not really. I was living with a young lady from Australia. We shared a duplex apartment on East 10th Street in 1986, maybe 86. Lovely girl. Hostage, you know. Ripe victim. And I've since made amends for all that stuff, just so you know. But this is 1986, and oh yeah, I am drinking in the morning. Yes, I am. I'm drinking gin. I'm drinking gin in the morning of a dive called the Village Idiot. I knew all the bartenders. They knew me. And I'm drinking, you know, martinis at like 11:30 noon, maybe, you know. In the meantime, this young lady is going to work every single day to support me and my lifestyle, you know, my lifestyle. She was supporting that. Probably to make, needless to say, that relationship ended, right? We were in the basement of the duplex. There were these two very nervous Ivy League girls upstairs. I was living in the basement terrorizing pretty much these three women, right? We got in a huge fight, me and the Australian girl. That was essentially over my drinking. And I became so furious that someone actually had the temerity, the unmitigated gall, to call into question my drinking, that I knew on that particular evening she was history. Anything that got in the way of my drinking had to go. Job, that's gone, you know. Any kind of obligation or commitment, any kind of responsibility has got to get out of the way so that I can do what I like to do. So that relationship ended. I'm kind of living on the street, not really, after that. I slept inside a lot. I slept in churches, not unlike this one, which were open during the day. I slept in parks to catch a little cat nap, you know, sitting up, doing that thing. At this point, you know, my drinking has, in fact, reached another level. And now I guess it's pretty much around the clock. So what I did, this is my troubadour phase. I never really talk about the troubadour phase. This is the embarrassing part of it. I buy myself a Hohner harmonica, like not the cheapest one, right? And not the best one, but like the one in the middle. And it came with this book that told you how to play the instrument. I got rid of that immediately. Put the harmonica in the back pocket of my Levi's and went out to do some music. This is also around the time, can I just say this? And I'll try not to make too much more of it than this. Long-term amphetamine abuse has a tremendously negative effect on the mind. Thank you. So I've got my Hohner harmonica, my Levi's, and my T-shirt. I'm like 135 pounds, maybe, right? 130, you know, a stick figure. I'm hungry a lot of the time, but I need that money to buy other things. I think you know what I'm talking about. So I'm sure not spending it on food. So in addition to all of the other things that I am ingesting, I'm not sleeping and I'm not eating. So I was about 135 pounds of madman on the streets of New York with my Hohner harmonica. Think of like a couple Bob Dylan lines I really like. Blow some random notes on the Hohner. Life is good. This was a time in my life where people started to notice me, but like not in a good way. And there were people who knew me who said, you might want to talk to someone. That's all. I'm just nothing about AA, nothing about drinking. Nothing about the confrontations that I was having on the street. Like, you know the crazy man on the subway? Like with the matted hair and the garbage bag hat? That guy? Yeah, I was confronting him. I didn't really like the way he was living. So I thought I'd let him know about that. You can imagine what happened, right? Best not to provoke the crazy man. That's been my experience. Right around this time, I'm going to say it's probably within the same year, I had a friend who liked to do what I like to do. He had a friend who lived on Central Park West. Her name was Kelly. Kelly liked to do what we like to do also. Kelly also had a lot of money. Or her father did. I don't think she had any. Because I don't remember her working, that's for sure. And she couldn't have been doing too much work if she was hanging out with us, you know. But she was from a proper family, and she was just like kind of on vacation from, you know, Vassar or Smith or something. And she's living in this, you know, Central Park West apartment. But guys like me and my friend, whose name is Drew, were the element, okay? And we were really exciting. And so we used to go over and visit Kelly, listen to her for a few minutes, and say, like, what happened with, when we were talking about money, like, 30 seconds ago? Why don't you just give me that, and I'll be back eventually, okay? Kelly had a rather crude depiction of, I think it's called Creation, the picture that adorns the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican, the Michelangelo painting of, you know, God the Father, I guess. It is the Vatican, right? Touching the finger of Adam. And I was not, you know, whatever. It was amateurish, of course. You know, that's a very sophisticated piece of art. But it wasn't bad. And I used to hang out on this couch at Kelly's house with my back to the painting. And Kelly had gotten a hold of a camera, some kind of Instamatic thing, throwaway, I don't know if I remember what it was. And I was sitting on the couch, and she said, is this the way you want to be remembered? And I said, yes, this is the way I want to be remembered. Then she took the picture. A long time goes by. And I rediscover the photograph. Now, in the picture, I mean, you know, my eyes are wild, whatever, I'm really skinny, and I'm sitting on the couch. But the finger that's not touching the finger of Adam is touching my shoulder. And I've always thought, you know, for many years, and maybe even then, you know, and I've done a lot of thinking about this, maybe you can tell, that the eternal, the infinite, is often pushing in on the temporal, on the here and on the now. That's a kind of spiritual, a little bit of an esoteric idea. I believe that God, the one who has all power, is with us all the time. I believe that he's with us all the time. It's my job to sort of seek him out. And what I'm trying to do, and what I've been trying to do for a really long time, is improve my conscious contact with God or a higher power through whatever means that I possibly can. You know, I do a lot of praying. I do a lot of meditating. It doesn't really matter what I do. I do a bunch of different things. But I've been able to sharpen, right, my understanding, limited as it is, of God. And if you look at any of the stories here in this book, we already mentioned it a couple times, right? Alcoholics Anonymous. If you look at any of the stories in here, they're all about, the personal stories are all about how the person found God, or, if you wish, a higher power, and how that person had now been able to do and to think and to see and to feel things that the individual was incapable of on his or her unaided will. And so what I'm really trying to do today is to keep that going, as I said at the beginning, one more day. I mean, I'm getting ahead of the story a little bit because I'm thinking of the finger on the shoulder. And the how I want to be remembered. And the picture is somewhere. I think I still have it. So the fun and games was about over for me at that point, you know. It was amusing for me to think about Kelly and Drew and Central Park West and all that stuff now. But that also had, right, like the kids in the field of snow in Rochester, that also had a very, very bad end. I may have suffered something like what they used to call a nervous breakdown. I don't know if they call it that anymore, but there was definitely some sort of detachment from reality, right? And I was really incapable of doing anything besides sleeping and essentially crying. Right? That's what my day was kind of consisted of. I was awake for about 4 hours of it. And, you know, I think maybe, excuse me one second, a little refreshment. And I think that maybe I might have gotten some kind of inkling that something around this time was wrong. And I was really afraid. I was very, very frightened, and I didn't drink, and I didn't take a drug for about a month. Well, maybe 2 weeks, but it was a while, and it was long for me, you know? And then I went out with my brother and some friends of his, and we started drinking, and I had a great time, and all of that went away, and I drank for another 6 or 7 years. Now, for me, and I've told this story a lot, but I think it bears repeating, it ended with me living, sleeping on a box spring. I had a sheet stretched over it. I didn't have a mattress. It was somebody else's apartment. The rent was $400 a month. Two grown men could not come up with $400 a month to pay the rent on this apartment. I'm sleeping on a box spring. Got two cardboard boxes that contain all of my worldly possessions and a white digital clock radio, which always said 6 o'clock. And I woke up this one time, and I don't know if it was 6 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the evening. No light ever dared creep in to give me any kind of hint. And I thought, you know, how did I get here? How did I get here? And I realized, and I was going through all the stories, and I was thinking about guys were dead by then. Guys were definitely dead by then. You know, I had been deserted by a lot of people. Nobody was really too concerned about me, I think I have to say. And I realized that the common denominator in all of these stories was me. I put me there. That's how I got there, you know? And I was fortunate enough, or circumstances conspired, or God maybe intervened. I don't know. But the window was open about that much. And I knew someone who was going to meetings, and she probably had, you know, 8 days. And I said, I called her up and I said, I think I want to go to one of those meetings. Now, I had no intentions of getting sober when I got here. My idea was that I was going to spin dry, right? Like, I couldn't afford a rehab. I didn't want to go to a hospital, detox. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any insurance. I didn't have anything. I had the 2 cardboard boxes, remember? So I didn't have anywhere to go except Alcoholics Anonymous, which was free. And I went to meetings everywhere. I went to meetings all over town. I found a home group, which is PAX to this day. And I got involved with the steps. And I think that as Faye mentioned, or maybe it was Travis, somebody said something about exerting themselves. Somebody said about doing stuff that they didn't feel like doing. I had to do a lot of that stuff that I didn't feel like doing, you know? I had to do a fearless and what? That thing? I had to do that. Searching moral inventory? I had to do that. With this guy who was my first sponsor. Awesome guy. I love him. And really helped me out a lot. But I didn't feel like doing that. I didn't feel like making phone calls. I didn't feel like giving people my phone number. Most of the time I didn't feel like praying, you know, but I did. And if you're wondering, like, what's the difference? What separates the guy with the cardboard boxes, or, you know, the guy in the field of snow from the guy that's standing before you today? And it's Alcoholics Anonymous, plain and simple, you know? Everything that I have in my life, really, I owe to AA. And, you know, the material things, I'm still kind of working on them. But I think that the important things in this life have been mine for a really long time, you know? I'm going to be married 10 years in October. That is not nothing by today's standards. I'm really proud of that. We have an 8-year-old daughter who is an absolute diamond, and I can't believe how fortunate I am to have this kid in my life, you know? And I'm also at the age where, I think I said 50, my birthday's December 26th, I will be 50 years old, that I'm old enough now so that guys aren't dying in car wrecks, right? And they're not overdosing, and they're not drinking themselves to death, literally, like my friend Zenon did at my house. He died of alcohol poisoning. But they're dying of natural causes. I'm old enough to have friends who are dropping dead of heart attacks, you know, who are getting sick and dying after prolonged illnesses. And I don't mean to harsh anyone's mellow. I'm not trying to bum anybody out, you know. And I'd hate to leave you all on such a negative note. But what I do want to say is, if I have, you know, one message that I would like to carry this evening here at the Atlantic Group, it's live this life. Live this life. Love this life. Thank you very much, Heidi. Thank you very much, Atlantic Group.